pull up a chair. I want you to close your eyes for a second, but don't worry, I'll tell you when to open them, because that's sort of the whole point of today's story. Imagine you're strapped into an open cockpit biplane, the engines ticking over in front of you, that low lumpy idol of a big radial. You can smell the castor oil and the hot metal and the wet grass of the field, and somebody reaches over and pulls a canvas hood up and over your cockpit and cinches it down, and now you can't see a thing. Not the runway, not the horizon, not the sky, nothing but the faint glow of a few instruments on the panel in front of you, and then they tell you to take off. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and this is the hangar, and today we're going back to a foggy September morning in 1929, to Mitchell Field on Long Island, where a short, tough, brilliant little man named Jimmy Doolittle did something that every single one of you has done 1,000 times without even thinking about it. He flew an airplane from takeoff to landing without ever once looking outside. He was the first. And the whole world of flying we live in now. Every instrument approach, every trip down through an overcast to a runway you can't see until you break out at minimums. All of it started that morning under a canvas hood. Now here's where it gets interesting. But first let me tell you who's keeping the lights on. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. And I'll tell you, of all the coins they make, the instrument rating one ought to weigh a little more than the others, because anybody who's earned it knows what it costs you in sweat under the hood. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, let's set the scene.
Back when Avigess was cheap and airspace was free, flying was mostly a fair weather affair. You went up when you could see and you came down when you couldn't. The old pilots had a saying, and it wasn't a joke. It was survival. Keep the ground in sight. Keep the horizon in front of you. Because a pilot who flew into a cloud in those days was very often a dead pilot inside of a minute or two. And I want you to understand why. Because this is the heart of it. The human body is a liar in the clouds. Your inner ear, that little set of fluid-filled canals that keeps you upright when you're walking around. It's a wonderful thing on the ground, but up in the air, with no horizon to look at, it will fool you completely. You can be in a gentle turn, losing altitude, rolling over slowly toward the ground, and your body will swear on its life that you're a straight and level. That's spatial disorientation. Pilots back then called it flying by the seat of your pants, and they trusted those pants right into the dirt. In the 20s, if you got caught on top of a cloud deck, or a fog rolled in under you, or the weather closed down while you were up there, you had a real problem. The male pilots knew this better than anybody. The airmail routes were killing men at a frightening rate. You'd have a young fellow flying the mail from one field to the next, weather comes down, and he's stuck up there with no way to get down safely and no way to stay up forever. A lot of them spun in, a lot of them flew perfectly good airplanes straight into the ground because their bodies told them the wrong thing, and they had nothing to argue back with. Something had to change, and the something was instruments, and the somebody was a foundation with money and a pilot with nerve. Let me tell you about the money first, because it matters. There was a man named Daniel Guggenheim, from the big mining family, and his son Harry, who was a Navy pilot in the First War and loved aviation his whole life. Together they set up the Daniel Guggenheim Fund for the Promotion of Aeronautics. Now that's a mouthful, so let's just call it the Guggenheim Fund. And that fund did more for early American flying than just about anything else you can name. They funded weather research, they funded the first real schools of aeronautical engineering. And in 1928, they set up something called the Full Flight Laboratory right there at Mitchell Field. The whole purpose of the Full Flight Laboratory was one question. Can a pilot be given enough instruments and enough training to fly safely through fog, to take off, navigate, and land when he cannot see a thing outside the cockpit? And to answer that question, they needed a pilot, not just any pilot. They needed somebody who could fly like a demon and think like an engineer and who wasn't going to lose his nerve when everything went dark. They got James Harold Doolittle. Now, most of you know the name Doolittle from the war, from the raid on Tokyo in 1942, and that's a story for another day. But in 1929, Jimmy Doolittle was already famous, and he was a genuinely rare bird. He was a racing pilot, one of the best in the world. He'd flown the Curtis racers, he'd done the first successful outside loop, which everybody said would kill you, but here's the part people forget. He also had a doctorate in aeronautical engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. This was a man who could feel what an airplane was doing in his hands, and also do the math on why it was doing it. There was nobody better suited on the face of the earth. Doolittle threw himself into the blind flying problem, and the first thing he figured out was that nerve alone was not the answer. Plenty of brave men had died in the clouds. What they lacked wasn't courage, it was information. The pilot needed instruments that could tell him the truth when his own body was lying, and he needed to learn to believe those instruments over his own screaming instincts.
But here's the problem. The instruments they had in 1929 weren't good enough. Not even close. Take the altimeter. The old altimeters of that day were crude. They'd tell you your altitude to within, oh, a couple hundred feet if you were lucky. Well, a couple hundred feet is fine when you're cruising along at 3,000. It is absolutely no good at all when you're trying to feel your way down to a runway you can't see. 200 feet of error is the difference between a nice landing and a smoking hole. So Doolittle went to a young German immigrant, an instrument maker named Paul Kalsman, and Kalsman built him a new kind of altimeter, a sensitive altimeter they called it, geared so finely that it could show you your altitude down to within a few feet, and it had a little window where you could set the local barometric pressure so you could correct it for the weather of the day. Now listen, if you fly today, you have a Kalsman window on your altimeter. Right now, in your airplane, when you dial in 2-9-9-2 or whatever the setting is, you are using Paul Kalsman's invention from 1929. That man's name is on your panel, and most folks never even think about it. It came out of this project.
Then there was the problem of which way is up. And which way am I pointed for that? Doolittle worked with the Sperry Company, with Elmer Sperry and his son. And they gave him two gyroscopic instruments that were brand new to the world. The first was the artificial horizon, a little instrument with a gyroscope spinning inside it and a line across the face representing the horizon and a little airplane. And no matter what your lying inner ear told you, that gyro held steady to the real horizon and it showed you your bank and your pitch truthfully, in the dark, in the fog, upside down, it didn't matter. The gyro knew the truth. The second was the directional gyro, a compass, basically, but a smooth one, because a regular magnetic compass in an airplane swings and lurches and lags every time you turn or speed up or slow down. It's honest, but it's clumsy. The directional gyro was steady. You could turn to a heading and hold it.
An artificial horizon and a directional gyro. Every one of you has flown behind those. They are the two most important instruments on a blind panel, and they went into service, into real practical flying use, in that little biplane at Mitchell Field. So now Doolittle had his instruments, the sensitive altimeter to tell him how high, the artificial horizon to tell him which way was up, the directional gyro to tell him which way he was pointed, and an airspeed indicator and a rate of climb to fill in the rest. But he had one more problem, the hardest one. How do you find the runway? Flying along blind is one thing, but eventually you have to come down, and you have to come down in the right place, lined up with a runway you cannot see. And for that, they built a radio system. There were two little radio beacons on the field, one at the near end and one further along, and a receiver in the airplane. And the idea was that these beacons could guide him down a path, left and right, and tell him when he was crossing certain points on the ground. It was crude. It was a grandfather, a great-grandfather, of the instrument landing systems we fly today. But it was the beginning of finding your way to a runway by radio. Now all through the spring and summer of 1929, Doolittle practiced, and here's how they did it, and it's clever. They rigged up a canvas hood over the rear cockpit of the airplane. Doolittle would climb into the back seat under the hood, blind, and fly entirely on instruments, and up front sat a safety pilot, a fellow named Ben Kelsey, with his eyes open, ready to grab the controls. If it all went wrong, Doolittle would take off blind, fly the pattern blind, and land blind, over and over and over, with Kelsey up front sweating and watching.
Do you know what that is? That's a hood ride. That's the safety pilot. Every instrument student in the world has done exactly that. A view-limiting device over your eyes and a buddy in the right seat with his head on a swivel. That is the direct descendant of Jimmy Doolittle and Ben Kelsey at Mitchell Field. The whole architecture of how we teach instrument flying today, it was invented right here. And here's a little detail I love. Doolittle was so meticulous, so careful about disorientation, that when he'd finish a hood flight, before he lifted that hood, he'd sit there and he'd write down on a pad what attitude he believed the airplane was in. And then he'd look, and time and again, his body had lied to him. He'd swear they were in a bank when they were dead level. He proved it to himself, in his own handwriting, over and over. Even Jimmy Doolittle, the finest pilot alive, could not fly blind on feel. Nobody could. You had to believe the instruments. That was the lesson, and he wrote it down until it was burned into him. So now we come to the morning, September 24th, 1929. And as luck would have it, there actually was a thick fog over Mitchell Field early that morning, real fog, the genuine article, but the demonstration was scheduled, the observers were coming. And here's the thing, Doolittle was ready, and he didn't want to wait so early before the crowd in the real fog. He made a flight, and then later for the official demonstration in front of the Guggenheim people and the press. The fog had started to lift, so they did it the honest way. They pulled that canvas hood up over his cockpit so that, even though the air outside was clearing, Jimmy Doolittle could not see one single thing. Ben Kelsey climbed into the front cockpit, hands off, just insurance, and Doolittle, under the hood, opened the throttle.
Picture it. The radial barks and then settles into that deep pulling roar. He can't see the runway rolling away under him. He's flying the airspeed, feeling the tail come up through the seat and the stick, watching the needle. And at flying speed, he eases her off, and the wheels leave the grass, and he is airborne, blind, trusting three gyroscopes and a fine-geared altimeter and his own iron discipline. He climbs out, levels off, flies a big rectangular course out and back, following his instruments and his radio beacons, making his turns on the directional gyro, holding his altitude on Kalsman's altimeter, keeping the wings level on Sperry's horizon while his own body, no doubt, told him all sorts of lies. And then he brings her back, lined up on the radio, down through where the clouds would be, airspeed pinned, rate of descent steady, altimeter unwinding foot by careful foot toward the ground he cannot see. And he flares, and he touches down, and he rolls out, and he shuts the hood pilot's part of it right there. 15 minutes, give or take, take off to landing, never once seeing the ground. Kelsey never had to touch the controls. Now, was it a perfect landing? By some accounts, he came down a little firm, a little off to one side. It wasn't a greaser. But my friends, it did not have to be a greaser. It only had to prove one thing, and it proved it beyond any argument. A man could take off, fly, and land an airplane, entirely by reference to instruments. Fog was no longer a death sentence, the weather no longer owned the sky. And think about what that opened up before that morning. Aviation was a daytime, fair weather toy in a lot of people's eyes. You couldn't run an airline on it, you couldn't carry the mail reliably, you couldn't build a transportation system you could count on, because the first patch of fog or the first low overcast would ground you or kill you. After that morning, the road was open, instrument flying, airways with radio navigation, airline schedules you could actually keep, the whole modern system where you file a flight plan and go rain or shine. All of it traces back to the proof that Doolittle laid down at Mitchell Field.
Every time you shoot an approach down to minimums and break out with the runway lights right where they're supposed to be, you're cashing a check that Jimmy Doolittle wrote in 1929. Every time you set the altimeter in that little Kalsman window. Every time you cross-check the attitude indicator against the turn coordinator and make yourself believe the glass instead of your gut. You're flying the legacy of the fog lab, and I'll tell you what gets me about it. It wasn't luck, and it wasn't just guts. Plenty of brave men had gone into the clouds on nerve alone and never come out. What made the difference was the marriage of the two. The engineer who understood the instruments, and the pilot who had the discipline to trust them over his own screaming senses. Doolittle was both men in one body. That's why it had to be him. He always said, later in life, that he thought the blind flight was one of the most important things he ever did. More important, in the long run, than the races. And he loved the races. And when you consider everything else that man did in his life, the raid, the war, all of it, for him to say that, well, that tells you something about what that foggy morning meant. So the next time the ceiling's down and you file IFR and you launch up into the gray and you come out the bottom somewhere else with a runway in front of you, tip your hat to the little fellow under the canvas hood. He couldn't see a thing, and because of that, we can fly through anything. My thanks this morning to the good folks who've kept this history alive, to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, where you can read the story of the full flight laboratory, and to the records left behind by the Guggenheim Fund and by Doolittle himself in his own memoirs. Those are the sources, and they're worth your time. You can find us anytime over at radiohanger.com. This is Tail Dragger, reminding you that the horizon in your instrument panel is telling you the truth, even when your body isn't believe the gauge, and I'll see you next time.